Accession number 32386, Mr. Bill Shepherd, Reel 4. Now, I wonder if you could tell us, is there anything else you remember about your time at Crookham? You know, about just what
not like? Really, nothing much happened.
How long were you there for?
Well, maybe about a year, I should think. We did regular exercises called schemes. We went out to Empire Day and all that kind of thing, and erected wireless masts on the village green just to educate the populace, showing off, and that's about it, you know.
How long were you at Crookham then?
I can't quite remember. It wasn't very long. Long.
And then what?
I'm trying to remember. The whole unit moved from Crookham into new barracks, which somebody built in Aldershot, called Mons Barracks. Have you heard of them?
Yeah.
They were just newly built, and three company moved into Mons Barracks in Aldershot.
Now, what were these new barracks like?
Again, quite basic. They did have the benefit of hot water, as I remember, which none of the other places had.
And did life change, or was it just more of the same?
Mm-hmm.
Did life change much then, or was it more of the same?
More or less the same, yes. You see, at one end of Mons Barracks was the main War Office wireless station. And we just had exercises, you know. I did a short spell as a batman in the officer's mess.
Well, tell me about that. What were your duties as a batman?
Well, we did normal care for the officer that was seconded to. His name was John James York Scarlett, known as JJY.
And what did you do for him? What exactly did you do for him?
Kept his uniform tidy, his room tidy and all that. Prepared his dress uniform for any function he had to go to. And he was squaring a young woman at the time who happened to be the daughter of Edgar Wallace, who was a famous novelist in those days. And sometimes John James came back from London driving Miss Wallace's car. What was her name? Patricia. Driving Patricia's car, and I got the privilege of filling it up with petrol so she could come and collect it. And that was about all, no excitement.
How did you get on with Scarlett?
With
your officer.
Very good.
Was he nice to you?
A young man, you see. He wasn't one of the old brigade. We had a number of wartime officers, and officers who'd been seconded to the newly formed Signal Corps, and they were not very popular because of very Prussian ideas.
In what way? How did that show itself?
Discipline, very harsh punishments if we did anything wrong. See, if somebody was given punishment like 7 days in the glasshouse, you've heard of the glasshouse, then if they marched there in full kit from Crookham to Aldershot. That was quite cruel, that was. After march on the public highway in full kit with an escort, and then serve his sentence in the glasshouse. I thought the punishments were unduly harsh. I thought we were treated more like convicts than as volunteer soldiers. You were not allowed to have any civilian clothes, and we had a very high rate of desertions, of course.
Well, I'm surprised at that. I mean, did you know anyone who deserted?
Oh, yes. I can remember Chippy Wood was my favourite pal. He was a driver at IC, and he deserted.
And were they recaptured generally, or
I never heard of anybody coming back.
Did you understand why they'd gone, or sympathise with them?
Absolutely. I might have gone myself if I had any means of doing it.
So you were not enjoying your service at the time?
Not at Free Company, no. I remember the OC of the company was Captain Hose, known to the troops as Kid Socks.
So what happens next? What's the next thing you remember or want to tell us?
I think we settled into the barracks in Monte Barracks, and then I think I asked for a transfer. I wanted to be near Scotland, because I could only go home once a year, you see. Because in those days, you didn't get a free warrant to go anywhere, you had to pay a fare. And going to Scotland, because it was quite expensive, of all the sort.
And was there much of a palaver about getting a transfer, or was it just grunt?
Quite long range, and I was transferred by some humorist who transferred me to the North Island Signal Company in Belfast. So we needed to Scotland, you see. Geographically, yes, but by transport, not. I had to get on travelling in the ferry from Belfast to Stranraer, and then by the train Stranraer to Kirkcaldy, which is where I was living in those days.
Now, where was the Northern Ireland Signal Office?
In Belfast.
Whereabouts?
Clifton Street.
So, was it just in a civilian building, or?
It was proper barracks.
You know, the Clifton Street Barracks, or? What was the name of the barracks? Just Clifton Street Barracks, or?
Oh, I can't remember. They must have had a name. The barracks as a whole belonged to the Royal Ulster Rifles.
Now,
it was called Clifton Street Barracks.
That's fine. Now, what was the setup like there? Was it just called the Northern Ireland Signals Office?
North Ireland Signal Company, yes.
Company, sorry, yeah.
The photographs in my little album, there's a photograph of the North Ireland Signal Company on parade. Only about 50 strong, you know, the whole company.
Now, we just looked at your album, and you seem to have gone there in about 1930. Would that be right?
Oh, yes.
And it's Victoria Barracks,
Clifton Street.
Yeah. That's sort of there. Now, tell us, what was the composition of the signal company?
Well, the more or less, was a working company, and we had detachments out manning wireless stations in various other barracks in North Ireland. For example, I was once attached to the governor's house.
Well, tell us about that, since you raised it. You know, what was it like being attached to the governor's house?
Very good. A small detachment with four wireless operators and myself, as a lance corporal, who was the fitter. And I looked after the charging of the batteries and all that, and what little discipline we had, because we were on 24-hour watch, you see. The place was called Baron's Court, near Omagh in Ireland, near the border with the Free State, and had an armed guard of about 50 B special constables, and an armed guard went on with the live ammunition, you know, and went on in pairs.
And you were the fitter?
No, I was there with the wireless station.
But acting as
I didn't go on any guard. I was.
No, you were a fitter to the
fitter.
Yeah,
I was a fitter electrician in those days, and I charged the batteries.
Now, tell us a bit about charging the batteries. What? Because it's a big job that they don't have to do now. What were the duties with keeping the batteries up to, you know, to spec?
Well, I changed them at regular intervals. They were. The wireless station was powered with 12 volts, and the batteries 125 ampere hour, six volt batteries and pairs, on in pairs.
So how would you charge them? What with? You had a machine, didn't you?
Well, I had a charging engine. But I charged them on the mains, because in those days, most of the electrical domestic power in the UK was direct current, not alternating current. So I could, with the cooperation of the power company, charge my batteries off the mains.
Now, did I hear you say you were a Lance? Had you been promoted to Lance?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I had, of course, got an army special certificate of education, which is about equal to a matric, and I was a Lance Corporal in charge of pay and messing. I looked after the weekly paper aid, so the money was right, and I looked after the messing and saw the troops were fed.
Now, did it make a difference when you were promoted to Lance Corporal? Sometimes they say it's the biggest promotion in the army.
Oh, it's the first jump, yes.
Did it make a difference to you?
Not much. See, it was a very small company and everybody had a job. There weren't people hanging about. We didn't have parades just for the pleasure of it. Everyone had a job.
Tell us about the pay parade then. That was part of your job.
You paraded then and you took your hat off to get your pay, and I had to have the money in the right coinage so I could pay each man out his pay individually over a table. The OC on one side paid the money out, and the man on the other side put the money in his cap. And smart walked out smartly, yeah.
So that was that. What about the messing part? What did that involve?
Well, it was a small mess, just getting the rations in and finding somebody who would volunteer to be a cook, because in those days there wasn't any army catering corps. And generally speaking, the cook would be one of the dispatch riders.
So you'd get everything, you'd sort out all the arrangements for the food and the cook?
You wrote out the menus and drew the rations and all that.
Did you have a Lance Corporal's mess, a junior NCO's mess?
No.
So you just eat with the lads still?
See, a very high proportion of the staff was married locally, and they lived out of barracks.
Now, how did you get on with the Irish? Either Protestant or Catholic. I mean, were you aware of the troubles? Because were troubles even then.
You're always aware of the troubles, but there wasn't the mayhem that came on afterwards. There's fist fights mostly, and you still had some of the streets with a barrier across the streets, so that you couldn't have a big crowd charging down the street.
And were you allowed out of the barracks, you know, just to wander about Belfast? Or
yes, it was the one unit in the signals where you were allowed to wear plain clothes.
Why?
Because you didn't go out in uniform. Otherwise, it might have been somebody picking a fight with you.
And did you have any sympathies or opinions about sort of the Catholics or the Protestants?
Oh, I mean, yes, the division was quite rigid, actually.
Did you side with either side, or were you favourable to one side or the other?
I married an Irish girl in the end. Her father was an Orange man, so he was a Protestant. There's a wedding picture in there somewhere. Yes. Very pretty girl.
So you met her while you were out there?
Oh, yes. We used to hold weekly dances in the barracks because we didn't go out very much in plain clothes. You had to stay mostly in barracks. We had a weekly tea party with dancing. And I found this Irish girl who was the most beautiful dancer. And I was pretty good myself, because before I joined the army, one of my hobbies was going to ballroom dancing, you know, which was popular in those days. So I was a very, very lovely dancer, and eventually we got married.
So what year were you married?
Well, I couldn't tell you. Not offhand.
So would you live out of barracks then, or...?
Well, I lived out of barracks then.
Did you have married quarters, or were you just...
No. You couldn't qualify to be on the waiting list for married quarters until you were 26. And you joined a long waiting list for quarters. But I lived with my wife's parents.
Now, anything else about your time in Belfast? You were there quite a while. There's pictures of you in, you know, Belfast, Ballykinlar, you know.
Well, Ballykinlar, of course, is an open camp down at near Newcastle in Ireland. It was also called World's End Camp.
And what were you doing there?
Just putting in your time as a soldier, you know.
Did the whole unit move there, or did you just detached?
The whole company moved there.
So when was that? Just after a while?
I think it was done in the summer months, actually. By the Kindler camp. It was by the sea, you see. You had the beach on your boundaries. Very, very cold, very cold Irish Sea. Very cold.
Anything else you remember about Northern Ireland?
It was my last posting before I was transferred to India. I went to India from there.
So, you went to India in 1934?
Could be. I don't know that.
It seems to. We're looking at your photograph album as well. Now, who did you go to serve with in there? What was the unit called in India that you were going out?
It was called the Waziristan District Signals.
Now, how did you get out there? Was that? Did you go as a draft, just
troop
on your
ship.
Own?
I joined a draft, and we went in a troop ship.
Do you remember the name?
It would be the Derbyshire, the Bibby Line ships.
What were those conditions like on that? Because those troop ships have got quite a reputation. What was it like on that trip?
Pretty rough. You slept in hammocks down in the hold. You didn't have cabins or beds to sleep on. You had a hammock.
And how did you cope with a hammock?
We just didn't cope. Very, very difficult to get into a hammock to start with. But you have to roll your hammocks every morning and all that. And we...
How crowded was it? How crowded was it?
Very crowded, yeah. Very crowded. We spent most of our time on deck playing housey-housey and other gambling games, which were, of course, strictly forbidden, but the ship police shut their eyes to that.
Which gambling games did you play?
It was housey-housey, and another one with cards. I forget what it had the name as well.
Crown and Anchor?
Hmm?
Crown and Anchor?
Crown and Anchor, you got it. Crown and Anchor, always gambling.
Did you gamble much?
No, I never had enough money. I was married.
You were leaving your wife behind, I presume?
Yes.
Now,
I wasn't on old enough to get married alone. I was only 24, I think, at this time.
Now, what do you remember of the route, where you went? Because this is your first time overseas, proper, isn't it? What do you remember the trip out?
Well, yes, went by way of Gibraltar and the Med through the Suez Canal.
And what did you think of all these places?
To me, it was an eye-opener, having lived all my life in Scotland and lately in England, to be in countries like India, you know. We went I think we disembarked in Bombay and went from there up to a place called Dera Ismail Khan, which was the headquarters of Waziristan District Signal.
Now, do you remember the train journey out there? Because people often talk about train journeys in India.
The train, it was very basic, six men to a compartment, and there were six cells which you could fold up, and you slept on the shelf at night and sat on the shelf during the day. The journey generally took about 3 or 4 days in the train.
And what was the scene? I mean, did you get a feeling of India as you were going?
Very much aware of the fact you were in a different country with different people, beggars everywhere, and people selling you things at the train windows. Boiled eggs is one of the things you used to sell us, boiled eggs, fruits and all that. We used to get proper mangoes, ripe mangoes.
Yeah. So what happened when you got to Dera Ismail Khan?
I was then drafted to one of the outlying stations in a place called Razmak.
Razmak?
Yes.
How do you spell that? I've got it, Dera Ismail Khan.
R-A-Z-M-E-K.
Just exactly as it sounds, right. And what was at Razmak?
Razmak was a brigade. It was a very active brigade. It went out on the route marches.
Now, which brigade was it?
Razmak Brigade.
It was just called?
Yeah. The column was called Razmak Column, abbreviated to Razcol.
Now, let's look first. So what was the setup like? I mean, when you went to Razmak, to the Razmak Brigade, what was the setup there? What kind of accommodation was with the brigade?
Small stone bungalows, made of stone, because timber is very scarce in that part of the world.
And what type of buildings are these?
They're just basic room for 20 beds and a fireplace.
Bungalows?
Bungalow style, yes. And it was very cold in the winter time up there. It was at a height of, say, somewhere about 6,000 feet or something.
Did you have defences round the camp at Razmak?
Oh, yes.
Can you describe the defences?
The picket with a very wide barbed wire fence, probably 6 foot high and 20 foot at least in depth of barbed wire. And then we had, in strategic points, we had what they called pickets, which were stone towers with the bottom floor of the tower was solid stone. It wasn't a room, it was solid stone, and you entered the tower on the first floor by climbing up a ladder, which was taken in at night, and you have a platoon strength. When you go into one of these picket towers for 24 hours, but it was always manned with troops.
You wouldn't have to do that duty, I presume?
Not as a signal. It was a hostile environment.
Now, tell me, you may not have known, but what was the situation? I'm not sure whether, is Razmak in Waziristan or is it Northwest Frontier Province?
It is in Waziristan. It's up against the frontier to Afghanistan, not too far from Kabul.
Now, what was the situation? Do you remember who the problem was, and what was going on up there?
The problem was that the locals were bullshit. They used to shoot at us and that kind of thing.
Did you understand that what was going on? You know, who?
Oh, yes. We understood that all the Masoodis were bullshit people, not to be trusted. Yes.
Now, so what were they doing? Tell me about the sniping into the camp.
They were living a sort of basic economy which was influenced entirely by the climate. See, in winter time, the place was snowed up and there was very little movement. But when the spring came, all the snow melted and all the dry rivers became flooded rivers. And the whole area got flooded. And then, of course, the flood subsided and all of the dry riverbeds had been covered with alluvial mud, really, from the floods. And that's when the locals sowed their crops, which was mainly crops of maize. And in those days, that's what they lived on.
Now, you said they were shooting into the camp. Tell me about, was it that just sniping? What was happening?
They were sniping into the camp. And when we went out on a column, which was frequently, we'd do a route march around somewhere to punish some village for being naughty, because one of the things that we were trying to stop was the, what do you call it? Revenge killings.
Oh, blood feuds.
Blood feud. The blood feud was very strong there, and we were trying to stop the blood feud.
So who would the blood feuds be between?
Between the various families, the various local families. They fought each other as well as fighting the British. It was called the independent territories. The tribal territories were called the tribal territories, because each family was a tribe really, and they fought each other.
And they sniped at you?
And they sniped at us, yes.
Now, tell me what a typical column was like, Razcol, you
call
them.
Oh, very good. There's a photograph of somebody called a column on the march in that city.
There are photographs, and we're looking at the thing. Now, but they can't see that, so just tell me, who would go out? What size would the force be?
Well, maybe battalion strength, with the wireless stations to match, and mountain batteries, gun, 4.5 howitzers carrying a mule back. It was quite interesting. You do about 20 miles a day marching.